don't say anything, because it'll just get worse if you say anything.
It's going to get worse either way.
Why did you come to New York and not to Israel?
Yeah. What is it that the world needs from these people?
So they became the scapegoat for Hitler.
You know, they're stiff-necked people.
Jews are the only people who exist as a network.
You don't see poor Jews. Of course, everybody thinks there are no poor Jews.
We like all of them, actually. Even the anti-Semites that came on.
As Jewish, it qualifies me as Jewish for Hitler.
Who would hate us? Everyone would love us.
The name Jew Function is just so fantastic.
We're not testing anyone's DNA at the door.
I'm sick of you talking about and using the Holocaust to further your interest.
I'm really delighted to invite Gerald and Patricia.
The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality?
Nice to see you, other than just watching you on YouTube. We've enjoyed watching your other conversations. And what you said a moment ago about, you wonder, you know, you put the little breadcrumbs out there, and then what happens? You know, do people pick up on it? And that you should almost have like a, maybe easy for me to give you more work, like a 5-minute follow-up sometimes 3 months or 6 months after with somebody that you have spoken to say, did our conversation change anything in the way you do things? Did it make you think in a different way? And the ones you don't like, you don't have to put on the air. And the ones
we like all of them, actually. Even the anti-Semites that came on.
We love being challenged, actually.
Yes. Understood.
We want to get to the, I don't think we can, we want to get to a good goal. And we want to be challenged. We want to find where's the holes in our bucket. What are we missing? Are we missing something? And on the things that we're getting right, we want to talk about it. We want to share it. So we're interested in hearing if someone else figured something out that we didn't, tell us. And, you know, and if you're interested in this and you're actually, not you, I mean, a person is actually interested in not just cycling around this for another 3,000 years, then come, let's talk.
No, it's critical, because we talk about this all the time. We debate among ourselves, you know, the only by getting ideas out in the public square and then debating them vigorously, challenging them, showing why they're wrong or why they're right, having the ability to see somebody's point of view on this or that you hadn't seen before. But we increasingly live in a world in which that's not the way people talk.
Well, I think
talk.
It's because we come from two entirely different backgrounds.
Yeah, tell us, where do you come from?
Well, my background is from, I was born in London, England, to a modern Orthodox Jewish family. Okay, so my father was a kosher tailor in the East End of London. And so everything was very traditional, you know.
No mixing wool and cotton or linen.
Exactly, nobody knows that. So I was one, you know, we worked on a Sunday, not on a Saturday, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, I was always threatened, if you marry out the religion, you'll be cut off. And then, of course, I marry a Catholic, you know, that was, but they loved him. But the problem in England when I was growing up, because it was just after World War II, there was a lot of Jewish resentment because we were to blame for the war. And so going to school, instead of going to a private school, I went to what we call there a public school. To be called dirty Jew, all Jews have got big noses, you must know this, all Jews have big feet, head down the toilet. It was very challenging.
I haven't heard that one, okay.
Swastika,
oh, yeah,
on,
swastika on the desk. And not really understanding, you know, going home to my mother and, you know, where does this come from? You know, why? And then even in the workforce, because my maiden name was Levine, L-E-V-E-N-E, it was very hard. It was very hard for me to get a job.
Yeah.
Because even, you know, it did say religion, but the thing is, you knew the anti-Semitism was there. You had certain figures that were very big in the anti-Semitism movement.
Colin Jordan,
people like that. And you were even segregated to neighborhoods. You know, people would say, well, why do you all live in that Jewish neighborhood? Well, it was the only way that was the only thing you could do, you know, and plus you had to be close to a synagogue and all the shopping. So for me, when I eventually came to New York in 1978, it was like, oh my God, this is just amazing.
I'm curious, I'm sorry. Why did you come to New York and not to Israel?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I can't answer that. But at that time, I'm going to be really honest with you. Yes, it was either Florence or New York, Florence, Italy. And I went with my mom And we went to see, what was the movie,
Saturday Night Live.
Saturday Night Live. And at the end of the movie, I said to my mom, I think I want, no, it's New York. I'm going to New York.
I've always said
Bensonhurst.
That's a great admission. Saturday Night Live made
really
the decision
hard,
for me to bring me to New York.
It was hard because you had to go and get a visa, go to the American embassy, you know, the whole drama.
So while she was growing up in that environment, I was growing up in San Francisco with a Jewish father, secular Jewish father, obviously, because he married a Catholic, Italian-American Catholic. And although I was raised Catholic, we went for all the holidays to my father's side of the family. They always considered me sort of the outcast because I wasn't Jewish by anybody's standards, because it was only my father. But I was interested in early age, like 10, 11, 12, at a really early age. They thought something was wrong with me with books like Rise and the Fall of the Third Reich, Escape from Sobibor. My father was in the labor unions, and I don't remember anti-Semitism in terms of people saying things, because I was at a Catholic school, about Jews, as you would expect, because it was San Francisco, which is a very liberal city. But they lost the ability to move into a house. We were never quite sure it was because he was Jewish and a labor leader or what, it went against the whole thing. It wasn't until I came to New York, and I didn't have it then, although I went to work for a law firm initially, that had, until 1956, no Jewish partners. And then by the time I arrived there, it was about a third Jewish. It wasn't until I started to do work in representing these twins who had been experimented on by Mengele as a pro bono case, and then wrote books on the Third Reich, that I would get hate mail to my, before email existed, old fashioned hate mail, because they would assume I was writing about the Holocaust, last name Posner, I must be Jewish. You dirty Jew, I'm sick of you talking about and using the Holocaust to further your interest. Those things were not a wake up to anybody who was Jewish, but were a wake up for me. Yeah. And then over the years, Tricia has been following the growth and resurgence of anti-Semitism, it never went away. Just one last thing, if I can. In 1996, I did a profile on Edgar Bronfman Jr., who was then heading the World Jewish Congress for the New Yorker. And they didn't run the profile because there was nothing scandalous or anything else, but it was Rabbi Singer was there and others. We had the weeks of meetings. And in the course of those meetings, he had just succeeded in getting the Swiss banks to come to a great settlement all these years afterwards and paying some money back for the money they had stolen. And he said, I think anti-Semitism is over. Mm-hmm. And I said, do you think just in your, I didn't quite say it as blunt as this, in your rarefied world of private jets and, you know, and multimillion dollar-
Bronfman said this? Who said it?
Yeah, Bronfman Jr. had been at the World Jewish Congress. He said, no, I think it's receded, that it's really finished. And I, you know, Rabbi Singer took me aside after it, Israel Singer, and said, you know, he's wrong on that. He said, you can't print that. He's wrong on that. And the more I look back at that, I thought, but it's amazing. He wasn't saying it to be clever. He wasn't saying it to be provocative. He thought that at a moment. And how amazing to think here we are today.
His pride overcame his logic and his.
Right. Yeah, very good point. Very well said. I think you're right, Seth. That's right.
But you really had no one really activist in your family. I had my mother's sister was a huge activist. So I think I didn't even know I had that gene in me. It just grew with me.
So the thing that Tricia has, which is fantastic, is that she has a natural passion about things. She left school at 16. I went through to get a law degree. So you think we'd be very, very different match, but we share this, that's why I think we're like-minded. You light us on fire and we're on fire. And what she dislikes so much, and I'll let her say this, but she's taught it to me, is she hates the part of the Jewish world that says, and she saw this as a kid, don't say anything, because it'll just get worse if you say anything. Let it just be, it'll go away.
It's gonna get worse either way, so.
Yeah. That's right, but we have friends who are, you know, religious, who are, you know, Orthodox, who are Hasidic, who won't discuss or get involved in anti-Semitism issues.
So this is the Bronfman situation, because I know Jews today, I'm related to some, who their life is kind of okay. It's not really touching them.
Exactly.
And if you are sensitive enough to feel what you might not even be alive to experience, you know, what's going to be in 30, 40, 50 years from now, or even what's going to be in another town, so 5 years from now. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're saying, Leo? So then it's one thing, but if you're comfortable in your life, just leave it alone. Mm-hmm. It's not coming into my sphere. Like if Bronfman actually, studied the last few thousand years, he'd see it always goes like that, and then like, mm-hmm. like that, yeah. and like that. And now we're just right here, but we're interested in getting out of this cycle of abuse, so.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I understand that.
I do a chart every day. It starts at 1933, like on this date. And it's remarkable. I'll say to you, oh my God, look, this was 1993, June 9th. It looks like today. It's just
give us an example or two, because we know what you mean.
Yeah, what happened today? If you said you're doing it daily.
What happened? Which one was the one I told you about the woman?
Today, as a matter of fact, there was a advisor in the White House who's advising on immigration policy.
Oh.
Who's a professor from the City College of New York. City College of New York recently became controversial because of the speaker there, and that particular advisor has gone over, has in the past, they've now seen, said things about Israel, and we could talk about Israel, anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism. I know they're all right. I don't mean to say that you can't criticize Israel, but it said things so inflammatory that to hold the government position is rather remarkable. Is it anti-Semitism? I don't know, but it's certainly bad policy. You understand? So sometimes, and this is the interesting part, you get this so well, people throw out the word anti-Semitism. We use it in the title of our little volunteer organization. What does it mean? You can get a very clear definition on some things. They're absolutely clear. You're walking down the street and you have a yarmulke on, and somebody comes up and says, a dirty Jew, and knocks the yarmulke off and runs on. Yes, it's an act of anti-Semitism. You're spraying swastikas on the side of a temple. It's an act of anti-Semitism. You're criticizing George Soros because you don't like his politics. I don't think that's anti-Semitism, right?
In fact, they had a story today saying that George Soros' son is taking over from him, but his biggest problem will be the anti-Semitism. Because you can't have an opinion, you can't say anything. You can't say he's bad, she's bad. It has nothing to do with their religion or the color of their skin or whatever.
I wrote about the opioid crisis in my last book, Pharma. I castigate and condemn all the time the Sackler brothers, the three Sackler brothers, who were the first in their family, Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe, the first in their family to go to college. They became doctors, three brothers, great success story, worth billions of dollars. But then they got greedy and turned it into a horrible thing. I condemn them all the time, but it has nothing to do with the fact that they're Jewish.
They use the anti-Semitism when it's convenient to use it.
At times. I think some people use anti-Semitism as a defense to stop criticism. That's true, which weakens it. And then sometimes it becomes an issue. I'm sorry, Seth, just to throw one last thing into the mix before you respond. And sometimes it becomes an issue that we don't think is as serious. We don't, and who are we? It's just our opinion. But somebody will say, we don't think that a non-Jewish actress should have played Golda Meir.
Yeah, it's the craziest thing.
And is anti-Semitic to have made that choice, and we don't agree with that. So, we're sort of like picking and choosing what we think is real anti-Semitism versus what I call the cloud of things that people may be offended by that isn't necessarily anti-Semitism.
So I think the most recent one that's interesting, I don't know how you feel about it, is the Roger Waters with Pink Floyd.
Mm. Yeah.
Should he have played in Germany? Now he's playing at the O2 in England. That's a real...
He is really odious, though.
I mean, yeah, regardless, he's odious. I agree 100%. But that's really become a huge debate. But, they say that he's entitled to his opinion.
No, I can classify. I can classify him. Nazi,
We talked about, I think, just in our last with our last guest. It hasn't come out yet, but it was just happening that week. So we discussed it, and I think the one thing that is clear is that things are getting very confusing. That is. Okay. It used to be like this joke, right? If you think it was like 20 years ago, I think so. If you think you know how to solve the Middle East crisis, then you don't understand the situation, right? Or it's those kind of things, and I think now it's kind of overflowed into this area as well of this broader discussion about anti-Semitism.
Right.
And I think the question that we like to ask to people, just to rock the boat a little bit, because we need context. The question we like to ask everybody is, if aliens came and you have to explain to them what is this group of people called Jews, what is a Jew? How would you describe a Jew to an alien? Because I think before we know what that is, the rest of the discussions are going to be always very confusing. It's going to be always going to be a question mark hovering over everything. So maybe you can go there first.
Well, for me, a Jew is a survivor.
And the alien would say, survivor of what?
We're not victims, survivor of everything, whether it's prejudice or whatever. I mean, look, COVID was blamed on us. We are really important.
So let's say this then. Okay, survivor, but from where? Where did they survive? You know, where they come from that they're still surviving?
Yeah, surviving.
The oldest surviving tribe. So this is very interesting. So aliens come. And I guess if you were asking, this would be a very good question for real anti-Semites, you would spot them right away because
they're a real alien,
Right, right. Because anti-Semites would say, aren't Jews aliens? And they would wonder, right? So they would wonder why you would ask aliens, because, right, Jews must be aliens. Look at the power they wield. But the reason it's so tough is, what do I tell these aliens? Do I tell them that it's the tribe that has been here for 7,000, 8,000 years as a singular tribe? And even though it was in the great, after 700 BC, the diaspora, they were spread around the world. They have no unified, quote unquote, country that we had until 1948, but they are people. Then the question becomes this: what if you're Jewish and the aliens arrived, let's say, in the time of the Inquisition, and right, you've converted to Christianity to save your life? Are you still in the definition of what I describe as Jewish? I say yes.
Oh, yeah, we have an episode it's called Crypto Jews. Yeah.
Okay, right. But what if you're Christian and you're marrying somebody who's Jewish and you then convert, but you don't have a drop of Jewish blood in you? I've done the 23andMe. I'm 53% Ashkenazi Jewish. It's from my father. Okay. Does that qualify me to the aliens as Jewish? It qualifies me as Jewish for Hitler and the Nazis. Does it mean I'm, Jewish for the aliens, even though I don't practice and light candles on Friday night? Or does the person who's converted from being a Southern Baptist and light candles Jewish? I don't know.
So you're just proving our point. It's okay. I mean, we talk about it all the time. So you can't define it clearly as a race. You can't define it clearly as one homogenous ethnic group. You can't define it as a race. You can't define it really as a nationality. So the question is, how can you define it? What aspects of this quality can you actually say? So Trisha said survivor, that's interesting. Although there are other people who survive things, it may be still too convoluted to say, okay, so, that. But what other aspects are there that?
Just say survivor, but from what? From what thing? What are they carrying on through all of this history?
So Seth, I've seen you talk to, professors who are wonderful and they take you back a couple of thousand years. We sort of focus on what I call the modern history from the fall of the French Revolution, like late 1700s, when the ghettos started to break up. So all the European ghettos where Jews are forced to be, they can't join the guilds, they can only do certain businesses, they have to do money changing. The Christians and the Catholics say, if charging interest and doing money changing is against the Bible, we're not going to do it. It's the province of heretical Protestants and Jews. And then when the ghettos break up and Amschel Rothschild and his five sons walk out of the Frankfurt ghetto and they know how to do money changing because they've been forced to do it for three generations, they become the greatest merchant bank in Europe in one generation. And then the Catholics and the Christians turn around and use it as anti-Semitism to say, you dirty Jews, look what you're doing.
So hold on. So I want to press on that point because none of the other guests brought it up in this way. Everybody knows that theory. Everybody speaks about it. And everybody knows that, yes, when the Jews came out of the ghetto, you could also look at a Jew and you can recognize them as such. They looked very different, right? Physically, they were all kind of symbols and signs and markings and the apparel. And also this other trait that you mentioned. However, I will challenge you that on that saying, just doing something very well in your, in your community for three generations doesn't mean that you have to be the best at it. I mean, there's good carpenters all over the world. Some are two generations, 10 generations, 20. Go deeper, if you will. What aspect of being Jewish, perhaps, enable them to be so good as tradesmen, merchants, handlers of currency? What is it in try to really kind of feel it for a second. What quality do you need to have to be good at that?
That is part of, I think, the survival aspect that Tricia talked about, because without that, and you're not just doing, you're exchanging money, not just inside the Frankfurt ghetto, but people are coming. It's an international, it's a European network of being able to stay outside of the currency zones where you might have a pogrom run against you in Russia or in Poland or in Hungary or wherever else. So part of it is that, but that ability to be able to do that is a business. It is a business element, is a DNA, and it would be as though you said carpenters, or let's say winemakers, you are the only ones required to do it. You're the only ones that told you must be carpenters. No one else wants to do carpentry because they view it as a less than worthy profession.
Yeah, but if you were a terrible carpenter, everybody would say, stop doing carpentry.
But if you're the only carpenter, they might use you. And in this case, they weren't bad. They were good, but they were good, the only ones doing it. That's right. They were good. And as a matter of fact, so good that the Pope had to borrow twice from the Rothschilds because they were running out of money when they lost the Papal States, much to the disgust of the cardinals and the Pope, that they had to go to Jews to ask for money. And the Rothschilds were pressured by other Jews in Europe to say, hey, you're making some money on the interest to the papacy, this terrible organization of anti-Semitism that's the fertilizer for hatred in Europe for 2,000 years as Christ killers. And they were. The Catholic Church did more to add to anti-Jewish hatred in Europe than anything. So the Rothschilds said, okay, you're right. They asked the Pope the second time to take down the wall around the Roman ghetto, the oldest of all the ghettos established by the church. The Pope said, all right, they took down the wall. When they paid the Rothschilds back the second time, they put the wall back. It's such an infuriating tale. So the thing is, you know, one last thing, I'm sorry, and I'll shut up for a second.
Yeah, that's okay.
It just gets me on a rant. When the Normans beat the British, the Normans conquested. I'm taking you back before 1789. And they went into Britain. They conquered Britain. Britain never had any Jews until 1066. And how did the Normans bring them in? As tax collectors, to collect the fees, to collect the levies. The British learned that Jews were people that collected the money for the conquerors. It was 200 years later when they kicked them out, but what a bad introduction. You understand, the elements of what I call this modern anti-Semitism, I can follow it, but it's just infuriating because.
Does that answer your question? Are you happy with it?
No, so I think, hold on, Leo, hold on a second. I think what Leo is asking is a layer deeper, and I think it's like this, because if you look back at the at our history, you'll find that many nations brought the Jews in order to build that nation up, and then they kicked them out, and then France was like, we'll take them, and they bring them in, and it builds the nation up, and then the Moors are like, we'll take them, and they bring them in and build the nation up, and Spain's like, we'll take them. So there's something about it happened to be the Rothschild family in that situation, but there's something about these people, though, that when you bring them into something, there's some quality, and I think that's what Leo's asking. What is the quality that these people had that allows them to, or enables them to do this thing?
Yeah.
The Sicilian family when they came in from World War II.
Yeah,
right?
Because the historical details around around these examples you're giving are specific details, but what we've noticed by zooming out and looking long enough that it doesn't matter, like you're talking now how like you look at history and you see, oh, that's happening today. You look at history, you see, so the clothing around it changes, right? There wasn't internet back then, or there wasn't Joe Biden back then, or there wasn't this, but the inner movement is what we're paying attention to, and that's the quality that I think, Leo, if I got you right, I think that's what you're asking.
Because I, for example, I'm terrible with money. However, I do feel that I have something, and the last few years have helped me highlight that I have something that is shared by those people that I consider Jewish. You know, there's a quality that I can say. So when I ask these questions to people, I kind of have an inkling to what that is. I'm trying to get you to think about it for a second, because I think you guys have such great heads between the two of you. I'm curious to see what you guys will, make of it.
No, I mean, and I'm not sure because, you know, Tricia says to me sometimes if I'm particularly clever, she'll say, you have a Yiddish cup, you know, you've got, you know, it's okay. All right, you know, all right. And I say, okay. And that's the head that's, you know, that's able to do things. In some ways, when you talk about that, and Seth, as you say, how they've been brought, you know, in all these times, you know, the Moors took them, and the Spanish, and then the French brought them in. But it is an element of learning to make a people, a tribe, useful and survive. How do you not have your own nation and at the same time make sure that the number of people trying to run programs and run you out of the country or limit you, or you make yourself useful and indispensable as possible to the powers that be? And
okay. Those are really good distinctions. So you're saying, A, they become indispensable where they are. Two, they were the only, or at least I think they still are, the Jews are the only people who exist as a network and not as a localized collective, right? They were like the people of the cloud before there was a cloud, right?
Because they
existed as a nation even when they were like separated all around the world. So they exist as a network and they're indispensable wherever they are for whatever reason. You know, money you could say is one thing, doesn't necessarily have to be money, but there's something, some quality. So these people understand, they feel, they intuitively feel the qualities of the network, the system, and they're repeatedly, they find themselves in those intersections, in those junctures where they are indispensable to the existence, survival, even, you know, growth of that network.
Okay, so right? Now Leo and Seth, and this is off the top of my head, so it could be completely wrong, but it is at a point when the countries that are using them or the societies realize that they're indispensable, that they become the most disliked, that they start to worry about them, because of course they are Jews connected to a network. They aren't really French. They're Jews connected to a network. They're not really Spanish. They can't
Sounds exactly like the Purim story. There's a people among us who don't have the same king, or it sounds like Egypt.
Exactly. Yeah, very much. So it's a good analogy. And I think that that's sort of the curse of it. I don't mean it in a biblical curse sense.
Okay.
Which is that you do it so well, the tribe does it so well, that it, what becomes at first a dependence and a like, then becomes a resentment.
Well, let me ask you a question. If I was responsible as a Jew, like Joseph in Egypt, or Moses in Egypt, or Mordechai in Persia, whatever, if I was, or any of the other, or any of the other Jews throughout all of these other empires,
the second to the king, as we call him.
Yeah. Right? If that was my job, and I made sure that everyone in the country had a great life, they had food, their children were happy, their children were safe, everybody had money in the bank, everyone could go outside, you could pick fruit, there's no debt, who would hate us? Everyone would love us. If we had fulfilled our role and distributed the wealth amongst everyone, not I'm talking about communism, I'm just saying, made sure that everyone had work, made sure that there's not crime out in the street, made sure that there's good education, what is there to hate us about?
Oh, so fabulous. Wait, I'm sorry. So it may be a bad analogy, but who were the most assimilated Jews in all of Europe?
All right, so the Jew function. A lot of people ask, what is this and who are we?
Are we anti-Semitic? Are we self-hating Jews? I heard that also.
We're like you. We're concerned citizens. We did our research. Hours and hours and hours of research into historic patterns, into Jewish texts. And I mean a lot of Jewish texts, going all the way back to Abraham and other notable sages and Kabbalists, and all the way into the recent era. You'll be surprised how much amazing quotes exist about the need for Jews to unite. So that's why we're doing this podcast. Like us, hit the bell thing on the YouTube so you can get a notification when a new episode is up. share it far and wide. You know, find something that you like. YouTube lets you cut clips. Share that clip with a loved one, with a Jewish friend, with a non-Jew who's like bothering you at work about something, and we're like, oh, that clip is exactly what I needed. Share it far and wide. Commenting is a great way to get a conversation going. And let's get back to our guests.
Who were the most assimilated Jews in all of Europe? In the
Germans.
Of course. They had become the great, they were more German than Jewish in some ways. And and they were contributing back to the society.
Absolutely.
And they were giving in terms of philosophy and art and buildings and architecture.
Was there something they weren't giving?
No. What they weren't giving up their Judaism. They weren't giving up the fact that they were Jews.
Was there something they were giving to everyone? Was there something missing in what they were giving to everyone else? They gave finance. They gave Hollywood, you know, German Hollywood. They gave architecture. They gave everything. Was there something that the Germans needed from them that they weren't giving?
Yes, what they weren't giving is failure. They were too successful, so they became the scapegoat for Hitler. They became the easy ones. They have the money. They're the ones behind all the armaments. They're the ones selling out Germany. You don't see poor Jews, of course. Everybody thinks there are no poor Jews, right? I'm sorry, but the thing is, I don't mean that as a facile answer to say it's to me, it's not a perfect analogy. I get it, but you would think they thought they were safe because they were so assimilated.
They did think they were safe.
Okay, good.
Assimilation wasn't a sin because those who weren't assimilated in Eastern Europe felt the same.
Okay, so as it were, we looked at all these instances throughout history where Jews tried to assimilate as a way to fight anti-Semitism. And guess what? It never worked. It's like, you know, damn if you do, damn if you don't, right? If you assimilate too well, everybody keeps suspecting, like, man, who are these assimilated Jews that I can't tell suddenly? I'm more afraid of them now that I can't tell them apart, right? Or if you stay as you are, it's like, why are they not assimilating? What's wrong about me? Right? It's almost like you're stuck between the worlds in a way. A curse, as you said. Not a biblical, well, maybe a biblical, but, you know, a curse of sorts. Yeah. So what is, so maybe the assimilation or maybe that particular, maybe there's an aspect of assimilation that did not go well with the hosting nations, you know? Maybe, you see what I'm saying? Maybe it's not, and again, I'm kind of like, it's not fair because again, you know, we have a very well put together theory that we kind of been exploring. So I'm not trying to, you know, to kind of, I'm just trying to see if you also see that maybe there's something off about this.
Let's go back to what is a Jew? Yeah. What is it that the world needs from these people? Or just, it's just another group like any other group who somehow luckily keeps surviving. Or is there something that the world actually needs from this group of people? Is there something that this group of people, I don't know, owes the world is the right way to put it. But is there something
maybe not O's. Maybe look at
O's is the wrong word. I heard Trisha said O's. No, she doesn't.
No. That
like that works out, right?
That gets you triggered. I get it. But
I hate my dues.
Listen. Look at nature. Okay, forget people. People is too complicated. We're part of people. Right. We're part of it, right? So it's kind of like hard to really see the facts. But look down into, you know, the animal kingdom. You know, the vegetative kingdom. When you look at those systems, usually when they're undisturbed by people, they work pretty harmoniously, right?
Right.
But you see when people come and they prevent a certain species, let's say, from doing something, you see that the whole system suddenly breaks apart, right? There's plenty of films that were done on that. I don't need to, right? If you remove the bees, then they can't, there's no pollination, there's no, right? If you take the wolves, then there's no, nobody eats the little gophers and then they eat the tree, right? We know all that in nature, but somehow we don't apply that to ourselves. Is it possible that in the system of nature on our level, on the level of people, there are also certain things that we are somehow obligated to do by nature, not by some, you know, almighty God, but not by some, you know, morals or man-made plans, but just by nature, just by virtue of living on this planet, being part of this great system, right? And we have to do it by choice, consciously, because we are humans, we're not monkeys. We have a agency, right? Freedom of choice, the ability to be not merely satisfied, but actually happy and find something that's, you know, a little, the bigger picture. So maybe there's something that we're not accomplishing.
So you have a theory, but
correct.
You're not telling us your theory.
No, I've seen his theory. And it's good. I've seen the, but that explains the tribe. That explains how the connections between Jews, right, that makes them unique as a group of people, but leaves aside, I guess I focus too much on, I get lost in the weeds on the geopolitical part, which is this idea that if as a, what, 15 million people today, right? That's it. That's 0.02, as you say, nothing in terms of numbers, but an outsized impact in so many areas, in terms of Nobel laureates, in terms of scientists, physicists, everything else. Because why? Because it's Protocols of Zion is right, and there's a group of elders sitting around a table.
Gerald, no. Let's say like this. The Amazon is a couple, let me see.
What are you for?
The Amazon is a couple million square miles, okay? A lot of things go, a lot of birds, a lot of snakes, a lot of coffee, like endless life, okay? But if you choke the Amazon River, nothing will flow into that whole millions of square miles. If you just choke the river, everything, all of the complicated processes, everything that happens after it won't happen. All the life, all the animals, all the culture, everything that comes out of that. If you just choke, we have this whole body capable of splitting the atom, of making the internet or whatever. You know, choke right here, this one little piece, the whole thing stops to function. So, you know, there are stiff-necked people. What we understand is that the Jew is kind of like this neck between nature and the humanity, this passage. And we're kind of just jumping ahead and saying, what if that is, there is some role there that the Jew has to pass something on to humanity?
And so, we're only asking, and I'll let you respond obviously to all those things. We're only asking because none of the other explanations seem to work. Like, as you were starting to say, Nobel laureates, this, that, bringing so much good to humanity on the surface, it seems like this should be the most celebrated people on the planet. Come on. Or at least, you know, not being persecuted. We see it's not the case. We see assimilation doesn't work, non-assimilating doesn't work. This, you know, political action doesn't work, this political action doesn't work. Giving money doesn't work, taking money doesn't work. Like, none of the things on the surface that we do are working, which is why we're pressing for this deeper look at things, as that's Seth right. was asking, right? The more systemic look at it.
No, and it's important, but you're right. We talk about all the good contributions and how great and everything is, and that's absolutely true. But we could also point out, and anti-Semites do this all the time, every bad thing, like the Sacklers and opioids or Jeffrey Epstein, or, you know, you could go down
find
the
every
list.
Bad thing.
Ivan Bosky, right. So it's both sides. It's good and bad. But the key is, I understand that in terms of systemic, it's very interesting when you say that. That would help to explain the special role of Jews as on this planet, that they have this, that they have this connection and play a role that doesn't require them, but makes it essential that they are functioning well and alive, because otherwise the rest of the body isn't functioning well alive. It's totally separate from the issues of anti-Semitism and politics and all of that. I get that.
And it's not separate. Rather, looking at only at anti-Semitism is looking only at the symptoms without looking at the root cause. Right. You guys started this anti-Semitism watch.org, and you know, maybe you'll tell us how, you know, how's that going. But you know, from what we've seen, all these other, you know, anti-Semitism organizations, they haven't even moved the needle, or some of them have become worse than the anti-Semites themselves, right? As you pointed out yourselves.
Yeah, so, we were one of the reasons we started our own little group is we were saying all these major groups, big fundraising, everything else is fantastic. Thousands of people involved in stopping anti-Semitism is worse than ever. They're not doing a very good job, maybe.
Or maybe,
you know, and somebody said to me, one of those organizations off the record, they said, oh, it would be much worse if we weren't doing our job now. And I thought, well, that's one that you, right, that's a great way of saying it. Oh my God, I mean, so anyway, you can never prove it. You're right in some ways that it is the symptoms, but and we were talking about this just the other day. We think, and I think it's true, that most people on the planet, maybe half, maybe more, nobody can do it, figure out the number, probably never even met a Jew. We think it's so normal, right? Our friends are Jewish, everyone around us.
I've met people that have said that to me.
Not just in America, but in Africa and Asia, you've got, all these people in China, so many people that probably just know a Jew by some caricature now on the internet.
Exactly. Yeah, very true.
And of course, you've added in the complication since 1948 of Israel, now a nation,
That just adds, it's almost like insult to injury in the eyes of people looking from the, from the outside. I felt as someone who, grew up in Israel and then moved out into the world and started feeling this attitude, and you don't feel it. And granted, I don't expect individual people to feel it. I don't expect them to bear this responsibility just on their own, just out of nowhere. Right. You can feel it. But if you, how does Sherlock Holmes say, when you get rid of all the, right, all the wrong explanations for the murder, what you're left with has to be the right explanation. And that's what we're saying. We're saying, look, network science supports this theory. Patterns in history support this theory. Writings of Jewish sages themselves support this theory. And that's why we're so adamant about it. Say, you know what, yes, we need to do a better job fighting anti-Semitism, protecting Jews, giving Jews a sense of safety and security and a place to go to and a way to deal with, like, the problems on the ground. As you said, kids knocking someone's yarmulke off and kicking them because it's just not good. You can't really function in this way. But beyond that, are we really solving anti-Semitism in this way?
No. Yeah, it's not. We're not solving anti-Semitism. We're not stopping. We can't stop it entirely anyway, right? It would be a false. But even those simple things that look like low-hanging fruit, that you would think, okay, there are kids attacking repeatedly religious Jews in Brooklyn and pushing them, shoving them, whatever else. The case is underreported. But they aren't getting any attention, and they aren't being prosecuted. Because the perpetrators often are African-American, young kids, they live in the neighborhood right next door. It doesn't fit the narrative of the press. They don't want to talk about it in that sense. If they were wearing Trump hats or whatever and knocking off the yarmulke, they would be on the front page tomorrow of the New York Times. So there's a political aspect. There was the women's movement here in the U.S., which was so strong.
Oh, my God.
And the black co-leaders of the women's movement asked the Jewish women who had come out of the movement because they were white Jews. I said at the time to Tricia that it should be Sephardic Jews. Jews of color should form their own group and be able to stand up. So even on things that seem simple, we can't get an agreement. And then people think so incorrectly. There is no tribe or ethnic group or country that's monolithic. Nobody has a simple view of everything. There's so much disunity, disagreement, everything else, that they think that all Jews are going to respond the same to the same incident and want the same outcome. And they'll debate it instead. Netanyahu will tell French Jews, you have a home here if things get really bad in France. And people will debate for the next 5 days whether that was the right or wrong thing to say. Should French Jews make a home for themselves there without anti-Semitism? Or should everybody think that Israel is the place to be able to go to? American Jews all the time make political decisions about how they view Israel. American Jews think they can tell Israeli Jews what to do. We hear that all the time from people who have never visited Israel, say, they should be doing X, Y, and Z.
Yes, so Seth is telling me all the time what to do.
And he probably has the right answers. But they also politically align themselves. So if Netanyahu is close to Trump and they hate Trump, they hate Netanyahu. If they, there's a lot of disunity, but that's not surprising.
However, and this is the big, I think, underlining moment in this whole conversation. If there is a group that would know or have a memory of being able to be united above the disunity and the friction, not making it go away, but actually somehow keeping it within, right? Keeping that little, that cauldron bubbling, and yet somehow being able to keep it together, right? So you can actually cook something with this energy. You can actually make something. It's juice.
Yeah. Absolutely. The way you say that, there's no doubt. Yeah. And it's really Jews born Jewish who can trace. They have to have the DNA in that sense, because if you can't have 10 million suddenly bring the number from 15 million to 25 million with 10 million people converting because they think they're part of a special tribe.
Right.
They really don't have the DNA.
And we don't, and Seth is about to tell you, we're not looking for these millions. However, I just read this, just to, connect the dots, because again, you see one of the places, for example, where you see this quality preserved sort of in a way that you can look into it, peer at it throughout history, is the Talmud, for example, a place where this constant, right, argument, and yet somehow they keep it all together. They trace it back. They don't get rid of the opposition. They keep the opposition inside. And the guy who the inventor of virtual reality, what's his name, Lanier from Silicon Valley, who's now in Microsoft, he was talking about how how he sees the way to save the world from artificial intelligence being misused. Not the intelligence itself, not the computer itself. They're gonna do anything. But being misused is applying principles from the Talmud onto that system, tracing, as it were, who trained the model on what and for what, and does it work, does it not work, right? For example, so I'm just saying, is it possible that we're sitting on a gold mine and we're missing the point? We're still fighting politics and this and this and
that. Yeah, absolutely. I'm open to that. I'm open to that idea.
Let's also say we're not testing anyone's DNA at the door. Because we also know that there was 10 lost tribes and who knows what's going on. And we also know that someone whose both parents are Jews with DNA may be a huge anti-Semite. There's also those as well. So
absolutely.
For the time being,
Soros.
the people who insist are on the directorships of the BDS organizations, who are on the anti-Israel organizations. Who
absolutely.
Are on, right.
Okay, so before my head explodes, So
we call them, I used to call them, I'm sorry to interrupt, Seth, I used to say they were self-hating Jews. Tricia says they're not really Jews. They are Jews in terms of the network, but they are self-hating.
Self-hating. They're just trying really hard to do the right thing to the point that it turns against them. Because Jews have that innate feeling that we got to make it work somehow. However, if you don't have a method for doing it, if you don't actually go to the root of things, you're bound to become too liberal, too progressive, too human rights at the expense of everything.
Yeah, I kind of agree and not agree with this, because I've spoken to a lot of Jews like that, and they are just one think, one speak. They don't want to have a debate. They don't want to discuss. It's the way they feel. And if you don't feel their way, then you belong in the other group. So
Of course.
And I've got to the point where I don't even try to.
No, for sure.
The beginning before the last. This part of our series is interviews, like finding people who want to understand this and want to find a good future.
Right.
Before we did that, when we kind of built our whole theory, we went through like 20 or however many episodes through this book. We discovered that the destruction of the first temple, the destruction of the second temple. I mean, even when this is like more kind of history that you can look into. But even you go, if you want to even like go biblical, I mean, Moses went up the mountain, he came down and they had the golden calf. I mean, it's like every time before the Romans destroyed the temple, the Jews were having a civil war. Before the Babylon, you can look at each time in history before some terrible thing came between us, and there was Jews on both sides of the conflict. So why I'm saying this,
good point.
Because today we don't require a DNA test before someone joins the team here. We're interested, and we don't know who may be a Jew, who's not a Jew, you're born Catholic, you're born this. We're interested in the people who have some inner feeling that there has to be some good future for everyone. And the same way you feed your family first, then you feed the neighbor's kids, then you feed the whole town. We're not just for the Jews. We understand it has to be for everyone. But when we wake up in the morning, do we go and feed every single kid on the other side of town, or do we feed our kids first? And then our family learns how to go take care of the neighborhood, and then our neighborhood learns and goes to take care of the town. So that's the reason why we're starting like with Jews here, not because we think Jews better. No, just that's what we have to work with, and we're open to whoever wants to you know, do that with us.
But we think that we're biased because we're focused on the symptoms, as you say, right, in anti-Semitism, which we are. So for us, Jews as a group are important. But I understand what you're saying exactly, Seth. I mean, the two of you, you and Leo, are sort of proposing this grandly ambitious, you know, ability to overcome the little squabbles that tend to rip us apart in the world. I mean, that's the type of, you know, grand idea that I haven't heard in a while in terms of a possible theory. So I can't say I'm enamored by it because I have to study it more, but I'm intrigued by it enough in the way that you present it to say it's worth looking at. I would like it to be true.
You poured over 5,000 white papers, you know, when you did your Mengele book.
You could,
what's 4,000 years of history for you? Come on.
It's absolutely true. And the history does tell us something. What you said a moment ago about the Talmudic lesson of what you see, nothing's erased in the before when the new section, all you see as you go back through all of the conflict, such the opposite of Christianity and Catholicism, where I was as a child, in which they come to the final edition, sanitized, everything else is heresy. And so fantastic. We used to do synagogue hopping for the high holidays in New York, meaning we would go to a different synagogue every year.
We would pick
like a different one.
10 minutes on board, let's go to the next one. 15 minutes, good song, let's go to the next one.
Yeah, this one, you okay? And we went after 9/11, which was only a couple of weeks after 9/11, to a synagogue on the Lower East Side with a young rabbi. And he said in the middle of the services.
It was taking a break. He said, for those that want to stay, we're going to have a chat. For others, you know, go and take a walk.
And for 25 or 30 minutes,
we were
all in New York, the somber, morose feeling of what had happened in 9/11.
I just lost my mother.
I want to talk about it. He said, how many people in this group believe in God? Everyone raised their hand, right? How many people pray? Almost everybody. How many of you think that the God that you pray to is all powerful? Most people raise their hand. And he said, so that God who's all powerful then could vanquish evil if he wanted to, let's call it evil for lack of a better word, but decides not to. He'll let it flourish because he decides it that should, or is evil limitation. He sees a hurricane coming to a certain coast and he turns it away so nobody's harmed. He lets another one hit the coast. He sees the planes coming to the towers and decides, so today I'm not in a mood to intervene. I'll let them hit the tower. Does he ever intervene? If he doesn't intervene, why do you pray? He went through a series of discussions. He said, I struggle with these questions all the time. I find my answers in belief and faith in the Torah. We walked out of there and I said to Tricia, wow, it was a sea change. I said, that was such an amazing conversation because you could never have that in Catholicism or Christianity. No one would ever question the basis of God's power. It's a matter of faith. You just assume it is, and whatever happens is terrible, is God's will, and don't ask questions about it. The intellectual part of Judaism, the questioning part of Judaism, the ability to know that you can ask questions and that doesn't make you lose your faith or your identity or anything else, is the great strength of Judaism, never made clearer to me than in that aftermath of that talk. But it's so clear that that's an element when you talk about, you know, the differences in, yeah.
But that's what we're after. We're after the people, as you said, not the millions and billions. We're after the people who are, first of all, willing to question, but to really question, not question simply, oh, is it the right or the left? Is it that conspiracy theory or that one? No. Look at the facts. And there are a lot of facts. We're not talking about, you know, 2 weeks worth of facts or 2 months or 2 years or a dossier or two. Talk about thousands of years. You have history, there's patterns, there's writings, there's big data, network science. You could put all those things together, and it's hard to at least be willing to ask the questions, is what we're saying. We're looking for those people who are willing to ask these questions. Is what we're doing working? Is suing every anti-Semite going to save the world? Probably not. So let's admit it and move beyond that.
Sometimes we have to do that also in the meantime, by the way.
Correct.
We can't live just being attacked. So there's a place for that.
Absolutely.
It's not belittling every effort.
For education.
Yeah, because
remember the young kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, two things. I think that Tricia said this, that a lot of people in the public, the media and the US, that they don't speak out on issues of anti-Semitism because they think somehow, and I'm going to paraphrase this, oh, Jews are tough. They can take it.
Yeah.
They're successful. And that won't bother them. It's not the same as somebody who is really getting a marginalized group. They aren't marginalized. So that's madness. We formed Anti-Semitism Watch because we thought that many of the largest of the American Jewish organizations involved in fighting the symptoms, fighting anti-Semitism, were calling out persistently only the bad actors on the right and giving a pass to those on the left. And we're equal opportunity castigators when we point a finger. Now, we went out for a while and we would talk to university students, schools, whatever else, and they would say, well, you're just a couple of writers. You need to have an organization. You need to have a nonprofit that makes a difference. So, you know, we do everything on our own. We don't have any secretaries.
This is the team.
So we formed, I did the legal work. I formed the corporation. We did Anti-Semitism Watch. We said 501c3. Then we went back to all these groups and they said, oh, so you ready to make a grant to us? We said, we don't do fundraising. We're not fundraising. Yeah, we are a 501c3, but we don't fundraise. We're just volunteers. We're doing what we can. So they went from telling us we should be an organization to saying, oh, you're an organization. You have any money for us? So we're trying to avoid all of that. Our focus is education. We're trying to get, believe it or not, something very simple in our view. In the United States, there are 29 or 30 states that still do not require even 10 minutes of Holocaust education in the public curriculum. It's left out. You know what? They're in there for a whole year in history. You can have it in for a little bit. Education makes people, we talked before about the people who have never met a Jew. It helps understand where the background is. Doesn't understand it on the level you're talking about with Judaism. But we're just focusing on a little level.
When we go to the schools to talk to these children, you see they're just like, really? Really? They can't believe it. They don't know anything.
We talked to a family in San Francisco recently. Their son is going to a New England prep school for high school. And he said, the worst thing I ever did was tell people I was Jewish. He doesn't have a Jewish last name.
Since then,
he said, I've just been hammered by the kids. And when he reports it to the administration, they say, you must have heard it wrong. They couldn't have meant it like that. Oh, they didn't really mean that, you know.
Oh, yeah, we had a girl from was that CUNY or City College,
right,
describing the same experience just a few months ago. Look, it's clear that we need to, at the very least, form some sort of what we like to call an environment of people, as we said, who are willing to ask questions, who are willing to experiment with new things. You know, we need this new generation of Jewish hippies that are willing to experiment with new substances. You know, not the same old, you know, ban them, sue them, throw money at them. It's that's not working right now. And we have some good material. We have some good stuff to, you know, to take in, and you know, we'd love to have people like you, for example, who have such an open heart, honestly, at the end of the day, and the desire to you know, open up to these things, these ideas, that already places you, in my book, on the level of
what the credential that we're looking for is that inner desire, really. And that's what we feel from you both.
It has to be an openness, right, Seth? Because I think so many people are closed to anything different. You know, you said before, Leo said, everything else doesn't explain it or hasn't worked. So here you have developed this new idea, and people are resistant, I think, sometimes to new ideas. We would say to friends, by the way, the name is fantastic. Jew Function is just so fantastic, because we would say to people here, oh, we're doing a podcast tomorrow morning with Jew Function. They would immediately, it wasn't like just saying, you know, with the Anti-Defamation League or something like that. They would say, what is it? We had a couple that actually went to your website and then watched the 3-minute video. They watched you also going in the subway and everything else, and they said, we don't understand it. I said, well, because you can't get it in three minutes. That's it. You know, all right. You need a little bit more of a deep dive.
So before we close, I think everybody wants to know, how do you give us a tip? How do you survive 42 years together? What's the secret?
I don't think anyone else is doing what we're doing. And and that's exactly it. No, nobody can comprehend what we're talking about. Who would even say that anti-Semites have anything valuable to say without saying we're anti-Semitic or we're self-hating Jews? But there's something that everybody's missing in this whole picture. And the reason why the solution is so close is because we're not waiting for anyone else to change. We're not waiting for the laws to be enacted. We're not waiting for a new politician to get elected. The answer is way closer than everybody thinks.
Like us, hit the bell thing on the YouTube so you can get a notification when a new episode is up. This is the Jew Function, and let's get back to our guest. What's the secret?
Oh, there's so many.
I'm going to tell you
respect,
what I can.
Respect, like, makes me laugh. I think I told you that before.
But I'm sure you guys fight every once in a while, right? There's some there's fire.
No, it's no question.
I
this
just
is walk so
out the room because so, I'm not going to be lawyered down by.
See, I'm a lawyer in another life, and she says I'm not on the witness stand. Forget it.
I know
and,
I'm right.
And that's so the worst for me as a lawyer. I say, no, I'm not done. I want to tell you this. What about this? And she's, I'm not listening.
But what's the glue that holds it together?
We love each other, but like each other. I actually really? Like her. We spend our time together. We talk to each other about different things all the time. When I have an experience that I have, I want to share it with Tricia first because that's the interest. So we don't agree on everything, but and you're right. And there's some morning you wake up and I say, pass me the coffee cup. And she'll say, don't say that so sharp. And I'll say, I wasn't sharp. She'll say, yes, you were. And you're in a bad mood about something else. If you don't stop it, you're arguing. And then you say an hour later, what were we arguing about?
But I can remember his mom, God rest her soul, would say, I don't understand you. Because we spend like so many weeks with her in San Francisco. She said, you're always talking. What are you talking about? You never shut up, the two of you. We're never bored with each other. It's like, listen to my story.
But there, and two last things, I'm sorry. She told me when I first met her, she said, you've got to tell me what's on your mind. A lot of guys don't. A lot of men don't communicate. They keep it inside. She said, if you don't tell me what's going on, what's bothering you, why something I did wasn't right or whatever else, we'll never get past it. And, I'll tell you, when she went through menopause, she wrote a book about it, but it was great. She would wake up sometimes and say, I want you to know I'm feeling a little blue. I'm in a really bad mood. And if I say something and cut your head off today, it's not personal. I'm just going through a bad hormonal change. That didn't mean it was any better if she did that, but I understood it. It was,
I also think when we take on a project, like a new book, we have to both like it. Yeah. So we have to respect each other because he's going to work on my books. I'm going to work on his. So we're always, there's always a compromise, but not forced. It's natural. I mean, I just think we were meant to meet. I mean, we were both lucky.
Yeah.
So is it safe to say that at some point you guys made an agreement, a commitment to one another that this is the connection you want to keep. And for you, that connection is more important than any other thing that's going to roll underneath any sentiment, any idea, anything else. It's just going to be feeding into that connection. Is it safe to say?
That's true. That's a very good, interesting way of describing it.
We don't have children. That wasn't by choice. It just didn't happen. Three times I thought I was pregnant. So I think when you don't have children, maybe there's a different dynamics in the relationship.
The books and our projects are sort of the children, that since they allow us to get into these, in a passion. And, we know that whatever we end up doing, for instance, in anti-Semitism watches, we're only going to make a small dent, right? That's fine. Better to have something. We can't save the world, but we can do our little bits here and there. We both sort of share that feeling.
I think we're both hugely supportive of each other.
Yeah.
There's no jealousy or envy of each other's careers or, it's just.
Yeah. Mm. It's good. So, knock on wood. I don't want to give us a kind of horror.
Politically, we came together.
There you go. Oh, my God. We'll get off the Zoom and we'll be fighting.
No. God forbid.
No.
Then have makeup sex afterwards. It's okay.
Okay.
You can see between when there's good energy between people just in body language and
she can.
No, I'm saying in general. No, like
we can too.
I'm a little bit of a lot.
What I'm saying is that I can feel between the two of you that you like each other. There's no like repulsion between you. And what I'm, somehow, and I think this is a huge lesson, and this is why I want to point at it, is that somehow being good together is more important to you than all the other shit that could happen. Mm-hmm. And that, so whatever happens, it's just more important that it's good between us And I think that that's, even if you have different opinions and things like that, and that to me is like kind of sums up, I think, what we're trying to do also is that all the Jews are different.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of different opinions. Like you said before, there's right wingers, left wingers, whatever. We want to have that kind of good chemistry that you have. We want to find other people who, even if we don't have the exact same opinions on everything, that it's more important to us, that it's good between us. That's more important than our differences and our problems.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. And that has to be the focus, because that's the strength. And I will say one thing. I mean, I'll predict this and it'll be proven wrong in 2 weeks or that with you, but we're your first, couple or your first two-person interview, I would bet that in the future, even if you go to panels or have two people, most of the time they will be on their own cameras. They'll be separate. We're the only couple that will be sitting together on one camera because we feel comfortable doing that. And I bet you that most times we don't even think of it. We say, oh, we have to do something together, and we set up the camera and then we sit down.
I would never have thought of that.
No, but I bet most people, have their own cameras. You'll have five people on a panel. I never see couples normally together on a single screen. Thank you for having us on that.
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
So I guess all good things come to an end. We have to close only this episode, but maybe we'll take you up on your suggestion and meet again in a few months and see how how that research of yours is going on this new book of yours about Jewish unity, and we will
that's
see
how very good. That's fabulous.
We will see how it works. I mean, it was phenomenal for me. The last this last 10 minutes was really the cherry on top, because it really was an exemplification of everything we're talking about. If you can make this work, if you can make this little unit work, the same principles have to apply on bigger and bigger and bigger scale. There's a reason why the Jewish marriage, that family thing is so important, because it's a microcosm of what I think we can create. Yeah, we can create this with humanity.
And talking to the two of you is so interesting, because never having spoken to you, only have seen you and then email, it's so easy to understand and connect to what you're doing, and you make us feel so comfortable. I feel like I'm talking to people that I've talked to for a long time, and I'm just happy back on a Zoom to have a conversation. And that's remarkable, because you're taking a fairly complex idea, because it's simple at its core, but complex for people to understand, but you make it very approachable.
And imagine, I didn't walk off and say, I leave it for Gerald.
Thank you.
All right, Seth, closing words.
Yeah, this is a great example. And this is, I think, points to our whole premise that we got to find something more important to us all for our good survival than our differences. We need to find that thing. And that's what we need to share with the world, more than the finance, more than the Nobel Prizes and whatever, that it's going to be good for everyone. Mm-hmm. We're going to start small, and we're going to grow it, and we're going to for sure do it with you two. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for being here. Check us out. Leo, tell us.
Well, it's all the Jew Function, thejewfunction.com, Jew Function on Instagram, Facebook, on Twitter. Soon on TikTok, I hope. We'll see. We'll see where it goes. But everybody here knows what to do, and share, comment, really ask those questions, and we'll see everyone in the next episode. Thank you, Tricia.
Thank you
very, very much. Thank you. We'll be back in touch in a few months and see how much we've been able to.
Anytime, any question, we're here.
Thank you.